I want to finish up talking about relationships, and I at least want to introduce the third category in our study of Old Testament theology, which is sin, evil, and salvation. And then that will be where we will go tomorrow. I will necessarily have to go a little bit faster through the material tomorrow, because we only have 5 hours tomorrow. And then we have finished the course. So we had talked about the relationship of humans to God, the relationship of humans to the supernatural world. Let me go on and talk about the relationship of humans to the cosmos. That is to say, to nature. This is the notion in the Old Testament that creation is good. And I want to emphasize that because in the Christian world, especially the Western Christian world, which in this case, by the way, also includes the Orthodox world, there has developed this idea that basically the creation is maybe not good. The spiritual world is good, and the created world is not really good. Is it really evil or bad? Well, I don't know. But there has been, in both the Western and the Eastern Christian worlds, a strong idea of asceticism, separation from the world. One of the biggest examples of that is in monasticism. And don't hear me saying monasticism is bad, because that's not my intention to say. But the idea of the world being bad and the need for the Christian to separate themselves from the world is not something that you find in the New Testament, but even as dramatically, it is not something you find in the Old Testament. For instance, it's perfectly fine in the Old Testament to be financially successful, to have a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, you can do wrong with that. Because if the world you live in says, oh, you have a lot of money, so you must be very powerful, and you act powerful in a harmful way, okay, then there's a problem. But having a lot of money is not in itself wrong. And that's the same way, by the way, in the New Testament. Having a lot of money by itself is just a state of one or another person's situation. What you do with that money, how you act because you have that money, is an entirely different story. And so the idea of asceticism, which has become almost an objective in the Christian world of high spirituality, is just not there in the Old Testament. And it is not really there in the New Testament either, but that's for a different course. But in the Old Testament, creation is good. The world is good. It's not that the natural world is somehow bad or evil. It is a gift of God which He created. He said it is good. He gave it to humans as a place to live in and to exercise stewardship over on His behalf. And the dualistic conception I talked about earlier, especially the Persian dualism, none of that is present in the Old Testament. The world is good. And most most of the things that we in the Christian world tend to kind of shy away from are things that in the Old Testament, it's not that way. I sort of hesitate to get into this, but I'm going to, I guess, plunge in, and then what happens, happens. But not only things like money, but things like sex. It's not bad. There is a strong tendency in a lot of Western Christianity anyway to think or to assert that sex is bad. Now, it can be misused. It can be wrongly part of a person's life. But in the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, a lot of times, especially at least in the Middle Ages and after, sex was considered dirty. It was considered something that people not only didn't talk about, but it just was not something that the church wanted to talk about or be involved in or anything like that. No. In the Jewish world, one of the interesting things to me, when I first kind of began to know the Jewish world, was they're pretty open about it. It's not a real hush-hush thing in the Jewish world. And I came later to realize in the Old Testament, it's natural, it's normal, it's something that is given by God, is a gift of God, and it's good. Money is given by God as a gift of God, or if you want, success is good and given by God as a gift of God. The issues are not whether the natural world, the created world, is bad. It's not. The issue is what humans do with these gifts of God. Do they use them and exploit them for themselves, or are they regarded as something God has given out of His grace and as something for faithful stewardship? And this is what basically is the relationship of humans to the cosmos, to the created world, and all of the different aspects of the created world. Animal life, which is part of the created world, is specifically protected by God. This is why, for instance, when animals in sacrifice were slain, the whole of the blood and all of the parts that heavily contain blood, like the kidneys and the heart and so on, those were to be burned on the altar to God. The portions of the animal that humans would eat were the portions that it was safe to eat. The slaying of animals to kill animals just for the purpose of killing them was not something that you would find supported in the Old Testament. There were certain kinds of animals that it was okay to eat, and all the rest of them you weren't supposed to eat. And all of these kinds of things are because God has protected the animals. This is why bestiality, which is having sex with animals, was clearly and definitely forbidden under Old Testament law. It was a protection both of the humans, but a protection of the animals as well. Because there was no place for the humans and the animals to have that kind of interaction. Going on to other humans and individual selves. The Old Testament view, you have to be very clear, it developed at a time and in a world when community always took precedence over the individual. After the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, one of the big changes that occurred in the Western world was the emphasis on the individual. But in the rest of the world, they never went through the Reformation. And so much of the rest of the world still places a higher emphasis on the community, the family, and these sorts of human relationships rather than the individual. And so the Old Testament takes as its basic level of social relationship that of the community. And there really is not much idea in the Old Testament of the individual or personal rights. And you see this very clearly if you look at the Old Testament law. The Old Testament law applies across the entire people, Israel. And you go even further, the Old Testament law says that in fact for strangers that come and live in your midst, they are under the same law as the Israelites. So there is only one law that applies to everybody. Now, you might say, well, that was forcing the strangers, the non-Israelites, to live according to the Old Testament law. Well, in Old Testament times, the Old Testament law was more generous than the laws of the people around. And so it was, instead of being a harsh, restrictive situation, it was actually a more generous kind of lifestyle or situation for the people who lived under the Old Testament law, even if they were not Jewish. The law would apply to everybody, to the whole community. And so the foundation of Old Testament teaching about human-to-human relationships is essentially based on the community. So that's where we start when we talk about human-to-human relationships. We see in Genesis 2 that God gave the woman to the man. And if you look at that, the purpose of it was that only through the relationship with her could the man reach complete fulfillment. And in this same regard, the woman would reach fulfillment. The union between the two became a basic unit of human relationships. Parents enjoy spiritual and temporal, that is, temporary authority over their children, commanding respect in the Old Testament. And the penalty of death is prescribed for a child who does not respect his or her parents. This was a fundamental, basic tenet in the Old Testament law. A child who did not respect would die. On the other hand, it was also the responsibility of the parents to require that child to respect the parents. And so you have passages that talk about spare the rod and spoil the child. And the fact that it is the responsibility of the parents to ensure that the child does respect the parents and the authority of the parents. Now, if the child goes into open rebellion against that, that is the point where the law saying that the child should die comes in. Nations were simply regarded as large families, and they were organized in that way. The Israelite people functioned under a clan organization basically until the Babylonian captivity. And you had in the northern kingdom of Israel, you had 10 tribes. In the southern kingdom of Judah, you had one tribe that had absorbed the tribe of Reuben. But they were all basically tribal. And they functioned in this tribal manner. And their areas of living within the kingdom were tribally associated. And the structure, the political organization, the economic organization of the kingdom was tribal. It was all done under a clan-type organization. And even to this day in the Jewish world, the family plays the defining role. In the Jewish world, one of the most important things in terms of worship is the Friday night beginning of the Sabbath. And as much as possible, the entire family gathers together on Friday night, and they have a meal, and then they go to synagogue. And then they may go back home and they may spend more time, maybe staying up until midnight, talking and laughing and visiting with each other, and then sleep late in the morning and maybe around 10 o'clock on Saturday, go to synagogue. And they may spend 3 or 4 hours at synagogue. Then they go back home and they have a meal and they spend time together until the end of the Sabbath on Saturday evening at dark. Then the family members may go off to different directions. But in Israel, people would travel 2 and 3 hours by bus to get home on Friday afternoon to be at the family home, wherever it was, for the Sabbath. And Saturday night, likewise, the bus service ran late into the night on Saturday night, so people could get back to their homes on Saturday night after the Sabbath was over, because Sunday was a regular work day. So even to this day in the Jewish world, family still plays a major role in the life of any Jewish person and in the Jewish community. There is still kind of a family clan structure by which the world, the Jewish world, operates. It's not as strong as perhaps in Old Testament times, but it is still there, at least in the background, in the way that most Jewish families and communities operate. In the Old Testament, theocracy, that is, rule by God, and the concept of covenant are also based on this same community, clan, sort of an organizational structure. When God made the act to deliver the Israelites from Egypt, He did not do it because 100,000 Israelites got together and had a prayer meeting and said, God, please help us and deliver us from Egypt. Number one, they didn't have a prayer meeting. Number two, as far as can be told, they didn't even have much knowledge about Yahweh anymore. That was a tradition inherited from their great, 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 great grandparents. But rather, the Bible says, their cry rose up to God and he remembered his covenant with Abraham. And he began the process of delivering the people from the slavery in Egypt. In Israel, before David, before King Saul, Israel was a theocracy organized around the clan concept. And even after you have a monarch in Israel, whether it's Saul or David or Solomon or someone else, they were always limited in their power by God. And so there was still a sense in which God was the real ruler. And one of the interesting stories that helps you see this comes again from Ahab. You may remember the story of Ahab and Naboth's vineyard. Naboth had a family land that was a vineyard right next to where King Ahab wanted to have possession of the land. And he offered Naboth money to buy it, and Naboth said no. He was faithful to his family, it was part of his family's inheritance, and he was not willing to part with it. Well, remember, Ahab was king in the northern kingdom, and he was one of the more powerful kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. If he was a general, common, ordinary king anywhere else, he would have just killed Naboth and said, "Huh, you don't want to give me your land, I'll just take it." But Ahab did not do that. Ahab went back to his palace and he closed the windows and he kind of maybe tore his robe a little bit and he sat there kind of like that. And here comes Jezebel and she says, "Okay, what's wrong with you?" And he explains about Naboth and the vineyard and he says, "What are you? A weakling? You're the king of Israel. Go take it." She says, "Okay, I'll get it for you." And she sends agents to Naboth to kill him after making false accusations. Under law, if a person was accused of something and then they were executed because of that thing, then the king had the right to claim the land. And so she took care of fulfilling all of these little details, and then she comes to Ahab and says, "Okay, Naboth is dead. Go take it. It's yours." Well, you see, for Ahab, as far away from Yahweh as he may have been, the essence of the Old Testament idea that Yahweh was still the real king still existed. He was still living, to some extent, under the Old Testament laws, traditions, and practices. And it was not Ahab, but Jezebel that was actually responsible for what took place with Naboth and his vineyard. Well, this is the thing. In Israel, Yahweh always was the head of the nation, even when there was a monarch. And so Yahweh was still, in a sense, the actual king, and it was still, in a sense, a theocracy, and the king was simply the agent of Yahweh, anointed by his spirit, theoretically chosen by Yahweh to lead the people on behalf of Yahweh. And this dates from the time of Samuel and Saul going forward. And this is where later on you also find some references to God as a father to Israel. And there are only six times in the Old Testament where God is referred to as a father. And at least three of those times, God is father to Israel. So you still have the clan, the family, the community structure in the relationship between one person and another and with Yahweh. And humans were part of the same family. In the Old Testament, they were part of the one family, Israel. And so that meant that as part of the one family, they had a certain measure of responsibility for each other, to care for each other, and these sorts of things. It created a certain civil expectation of the people because of being part of the one community. The covenant between Yahweh and Abraham, or Yahweh and David, or Yahweh and Israel, was perceived as extending not to just individuals, but to Abraham, David, Israel, and their descendants throughout their generations. Since Yahweh was eternal, any covenant he made would also likewise be eternal. One of the things that you see in the Old Testament is sometimes a group personality. And you see this especially with the prophets, who do not so much criticize an individual, but criticize an entire community and talk about the entire community rather than simply individuals within the community. Corporate punishment was common in the Old Testament. And one of the very vivid examples came from the time when the Israelites were first early into the Promised Land. After they had experienced the fall of Jericho, Joshua had put Jericho under a ban. They were not to take anything but to basically just bury the entire city under its debris. But there was one family who had taken things from Jericho and hidden them underneath the floors of their tents. And when the Israelite army went up into the hill country to Ai, the first time they went up, they were defeated. And Joshua went to God and said, "Hey, what gives? I thought you were on our side." And God says, "There's sin among the people." And they go through this process to identify the family that had taken these things from Jericho in violation of the ban. And when they identify the specific family that did it, the entire family is killed. It's a gruesome story and a gruesome scene. But it demonstrates the concept of community and how important community was in that day. The idea in this situation in particular was that because of the closeness with which families lived together, you could not assign responsibility just to this family member for having hidden everything. The whole family had to be in on the conspiracy. And so the whole family was guilty and the whole family was punished. And to give you some sense of the size of the dwellings that the people lived in, even up into Hezekiah's day, for the most part, the people lived in very small dwellings that you could put at least three and maybe four of their houses in this room. And it was just very close quarters, and it was very often multiple generations. Parents, children, grandparents, maybe great-grandparents, maybe grandchildren. And it was just a very compact, tight kind of small community for each family. And so corporate punishment was oftentimes found in the Old Testament and just simply accepted as part of the way things are. Now, in the Western world today, corporate punishment is something people feel very, very uncomfortable with. Now, I don't know how you feel here, but it's something they feel very uncomfortable with because there is such a heavy emphasis on individualism. I'm not guilty. They may have done it, other family members, but I didn't do it. I'm not guilty. But in the Old Testament times, if a family was guilty, all of the members of the family were guilty. The individual, as I said, in Old Testament times and in the Old Testament, really doesn't figure too strongly into the world of the Old Testament. And individuals, whether it be the relationship to himself or herself, or an individual, singular, in relationship to other people, generally is not covered in a major way. However, you do have some individualism, particularly in the Old Testament law, which was unique for its day because all the peoples around had no laws that respected individuals in any degree. But for instance, property crimes could not be punished by capital punishment. There were punishments. Property crimes means stealing something from somebody else. But property crimes were not punished by capital punishment. And generally speaking, the whole family did not suffer, but only the one who was responsible for the property crime. Slavery, as I said in a previous lecture, it was regulated, but it was not outlawed. Slaves were accorded rights and even a measure of respect within the society. And in fact, slaves were, as I said before, something like employees as we think of them today. And So slavery had an entirely different structure to it in the society than what we have today. And as I said a little while ago, strangers in the midst of Israel, that's individuals who were not Jewish or Israelite, but who lived in the midst of Israel, had legal protections. They had the same legal protections as Israelites did, and the same right to ask protection from the law if their rights were violated, like if somebody stole something from them or a family member of theirs was murdered or something like that. They had the right to apply Israelite law to their situation just as if they were an Israelite, even though they were not an Israelite and not even necessarily participating within the Israelite religious faith. And in the Old Testament, responsibility before God was both a group, that is to say, corporate or community responsibility, and an individual responsibility. So it was not just the community has to be responsible before God, but each member of the community is to be responsible before God as well. Well, let me just introduce the topics of sin, evil, and salvation, because this is another major area to look at in Old Testament theology. In sin, evil, and salvation, the Bible begins with essentially sort of the story of the fall. Later on, the Bible suggests that even before the fall of man, there was an earlier fall. And this is what I already mentioned with regard to Satan. Isaiah 14, 12 to 19 talks about this. Ezekiel 28, 11 to 19 also hints at some fall in the heavenly realm before the heaven and earth was ever created. And the New Testament supports this idea, but does not really elaborate very much on it. So you have passages in Luke 10, 18 and 2 Peter 2, 4 and Jude 6 that support the idea of a fall in the heavenly realm before the creation of heaven and earth. I will tell you, just for what it's worth, there are some people who suggest that actually there was an earth before the creation we know, and that earth was an earth that was filled with dinosaurs and so forth like that, and it was the primeval, the earlier fall, that was what led to the destruction of the earth in that very early time period and caused the earth to become tohu wabohu, in other words, without form and void. And the earth that you read about in Genesis, basically Genesis 1-3, God said, let there be light, and so on like that, is the beginning of a recreation of earth. I'm not particularly supportive of that theory, but you may, if you are reading things on Old Testament theology or even just religion in general, you may run into this idea, because it's a well-known enough idea that some people will talk about it. It's not really a particularly Jewish idea. It's mostly either out of a very modern, creative mind, or at least out of a Christian source. But the reality is the Bible does suggest before Genesis 1:3, or maybe before Genesis 1:2, that there was some kind of a fall in heaven in which the adversary, or Lucifer, as he was known as the light bearer, was cast out of heaven and took a third of heaven with him when he was cast out from heaven. So this is recounted in the Bible, and this much can be said, that there was some kind of an activity like that. Was it before the creation of the earth or after the creation of the earth? The Bible does not say. But there was some kind of event that took place. And it is then associated with the whole discussion on sin and evil as it relates to the Old Testament, as well as, to some extent, of course, the New Testament.